Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said it's time for Iranian-backed militia and their Iranian advisors who helped Iraq defeat Islamic State to go home.
Any foreign fighters in Iraq need to go home and allow the Iraqi people to regain control of areas that had been overtaken by ISIS and Daesh that have now been liberated, allow the Iraqi people to rebuild their lives with the help of their neighbors.
Tillerson was taking part in the initial meeting of the Saudi Arabia-Iraq Coordination Committee in Riyadh. Indiana University's Hussein Banai said it appears to be intended to limit Iran's influence in Iraq and elsewhere in the region.
This is something that obviously the Saudis and many of the other Gulf Cooperation Council countries have been lobbying Washington on. Going back to the latter part of the Bush administration, throughout the Obama administration, and now in the Trump administration, they finally have found a willing partner to actually support that move.
Ties between Shia-majority Iraq and Sunni-led Saudi Arabia have been strained since Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Saudi Arabia reopened its embassy in Baghdad in 2015. The two countries have also reopened a border crossing and resumed flights between their respective capitals. Tillerson also visited Qatar and is scheduled to make stops in Pakistan, India, and Switzerland. Ethnic clashes between Oromos and Amharas in Ethiopia have resulted in at least 11 deaths in the past week, centered on the restive Oromia region, the country's largest province racked by violence in recent years. Nearly 700 died last year, forcing the government to impose a nearly one-year state of emergency following a proposed development plan issued by Addis Ababa. This is VOA News. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party scored a big victory in Sunday's snap election, keeping its two-thirds supermajority in the lower house, despite suffering some losses. LDP supporter Satoru Abe, no relation to the Prime Minister, said the results reflect who the people believe is most capable of protecting the country. The Prime Minister said the election turned on the growing North Korean threat. It was an impressive win, but with little opposition, according to Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston.
The big benefit to the ruling coalition was that they were running against a divided opposition. One, the ruling party is running against more than one other candidate. The opposition divides the anti-LDP vote, and the LDP romps to victory.
Mr. Abe must now win re-election next year as LDP leader. If he does, he's expected to serve until 2021. Two northern Italian regions voted overwhelmingly Sunday for greater autonomy from Rome. More than 90% of those casting ballots in Lombardy and Veneto said yes to enter negotiations for a better financial arrangement.
Quello che conta per me è che questo dato.
Lombardy President Roberto Maroni said he's happy with the result and now he intends to go to Rome and seek additional resources for his region. Unlike Spain and Catalonia, these referenda were undertaken within the Constitution. Slovenia's incumbent President Borut Pahor will face his second-round runoff on November 12. After falling short of a first-round victory Sunday in his bid for a second five-year term. Mr. Pahor took 47% of the vote. He'll face Komnik mayor Marjan Saric, who took 25%. In Argentina, candidates backed by pro-reformist President Mauricio Macri swept a victory Sunday in midterm elections, strengthening his position in Congress. In a close election, Mr. Macri's former education minister, Esteban Bullrich, led former President Cristina Fernandez in a Senate race in Buenos Aires province. Nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims have now sought refuge in Bangladesh following a cross-border crackdown in Myanmar, also known as Burma. Michael Dunford is with the World Food Program trying to care for this growing humanitarian crisis.
WFP's already fed 580,000 refugees. Just yesterday, we fed an additional 10,000 as they came across the border. But we're still scaling up. We still need to reach up to 1 million people.
He said the WFP will need more than $50 million to care for refugees through February. In Syria, U.S.-backed rebels claim to have captured a major oil field in Deir ez-Zor province Sunday as they press an offensive against Islamic State in the east. With support from U.S. airstrikes and coalition special forces, elements of the Syrian Democratic Forces took possession of the old Amar oil field. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Health Organization rescinds its appointment of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe as its goodwill ambassador.
The decision to grant Mr. Mugabe that appointment was wrong in the first place. It was wrong, it was immoral, it was unscientific. Mugabe doesn't even seek treatment in Zimbabwe.
Douglas Mwanzura is the Secretary General of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change. Burundi is set to become the first African country to withdraw from the International Criminal Court this Friday. Liberia's police chief says there will be no anti-election demonstrations in the capital. And Sudan and the U.S. will meet next month to discuss removing Sudan from the U.S. list of states of sponsor of terrorism.
As you know, Sudan is an important country in the region. And the U.S. is the most important country in the world. And historically, we've been friends. We look forward to combat that history and engage excellent bilateral relations for the benefit of the continent, for the benefit of the people of the two countries.
Professor Ibrahim Gandoo is Sudan's foreign minister. Victims of former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh and activists have launched a campaign to bring him to justice. And a South African bakery slices prices and sees its sales skyrocket. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization bowed to international pressure on Sunday and rescinded the appointment of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe as its goodwill ambassador. As viewer Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the news was received with joy by the country's opposition and activists.
In a statement on Sunday, the World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he was dissenting on his appointment of Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe as WHO's non-communicable diseases goodwill ambassador for Africa. Douglas Mwanzura, the Secretary General of Zimbabwe's main opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, which had opposed the appointment of the 93-year-old Mugabe as WHO non-communicable disease goodwill ambassador for Africa last week, comments on the decision by the WHO to reverse its decision on Sunday.
The decision to grant Mr. Mugabe that appointment was wrong in the first place. It was wrong, it was immoral, it was unscientific. We were surprised that the whole world, which must have its eyes open on Zimbabwe, does not know how this man has killed the health system of Zimbabwe. Mugabe doesn't even seek treatment in Zimbabwe.
Psychologist Mazwisa, a ruling ZANU-PF party member of parliament, comments on WHO's decision to remove President Mugabe as his ambassador.
That was a befitting honor, but of course they've had to rescind it for political reasons. There's a lot of political meddling in the internal affairs of Zimbabwe. The very people who sponsor the World Health Organization are the very same people who imposed illegal sanctions on Zimbabwe.
That was an apparent reference to the United Kingdom, Zimbabwe's former colonial master, and the United States, which President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party blames for sanctions imposed on him and senior members of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party following reports of election rigging and human rights abuses in 2002. Sebastian Mofu, VOA News, Harare.
Burundi will this Friday become the first African country to officially withdraw from the International Criminal Court. As Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura, the day is coming 1 year after President Pierre Nkurunziza signed a legislation calling for Burundi's withdrawal.
Under the ICC's statute, withdrawal does not come into effect until 1 year after the state has formally announced to the UN Secretary General. Burundi Minister for Human Rights Martin Nivyabandi said that the ICC was targeting weak nations in Africa.
After the crisis of 2015, the opponent would like to use it as a tool to destabilize government and all institutions. As African, we realized that it was a court set up to facilitate the destabilize institutions of what we call weak nations. It gives the impression that it is a court for Africans only.
The US-based Human Rights Watch said Burundi has failed to hold responsible people who have committed brutal crimes, and that withdrawal is an attempt to deny victims justice. But Burundi Human Rights Minister Martin Nivyabandi said that the country is fighting impunity.
Burundi, we passed through different difficulties, but unfortunately who took many lives of people. It is an obligation for a government to deal with problems related to impunity. Burundi would never tolerate impunity in the country. We will fight against it, and we'll do our best in order to take the perpetrators of crimes to court.
Burundi opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, said that the decision to withdraw from the ICC was made by the ruling party and does not reflect the will of all Burundians.
As long as there is no justice, Burundians will need some other courts more than local courts. So I think it is just a political decision from the ruling party. If impunity was decried in the 60s, 70s, 1890s, and if it is now decried, what about Burundi withdrawal if it cannot guarantee that every Burundian enjoys his rights in the country?
Here in Nyakabiga, it's a place where the protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza happened in 2015, but many of the people here are reluctant to comment on the Burundi's position to withdraw from the International Criminal Court, and the majority of them barely knows about the court.
I met a professor from a university in Bujumbura. He preferred not to disclose his name.
Crimes have been committed, and it's clear people died. Some civil society talk about over 1,000 people who were killed from 2015. The government is saying it's ordinary crimes, but it's not ordinary crimes. So there are people, of course, who have to answer for those atrocities.
Though Burundi seems to be regaining relative stability after the violence that erupted in 2015 and claimed lives of more than 500 people, targeted killings have continued in the country. As Burundi prepares to leave the ICC, the burning question here is whether the country's judicial body will be able to bring to justice alleged perpetrators of crimes against humanity. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 23rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 13 minutes past the hour. Sudan's foreign minister says removing his country from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism will top the agenda when the two countries meet next month on normalizing their bilateral relations. The meeting followed the United States lifting of economic sanctions on Sudan this month. Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour says Sudan and the United States have always enjoyed good relations prior to the imposition of the sanction 20 years ago. He says a return to normalization of relations would be beneficial to both countries.
In fact, as you know, that for the last 16 months, Sudan and the U.S. have been engaged in the rigorous diplomatic talks on bilateral relations. The main issue was the economic sanctions imposed in Sudan by the United States of America. And that discussion, in fact, gave the basic results in removing the sanctions, and they were revoked by His Excellency President Donald Trump this month. And now we are supposed to start each year of our talks being on the U.S. list of countries supporting terrorism. Really been no interest with that, as it has been stated and exposed many times by the CIA in particular in 2009, that Sudan is not supporting terrorist groups and is still being on the list that is being a paradox. And this is why we are determined to engage also in diplomatic negotiation in order to get Sudan removed from that list. As you know, Sudan is an important country in the region, and the U.S. is the most important country in the world. Sudan and the U.S. have been very excellent relations, and historically, we've been friends. We look forward to come back to that history so for the benefit of the continent or the benefit of the people of the two countries.
Mr. Foreign Minister, you know, earlier this month, the United States lifted almost a 20-year-old economic sanctions on your country. Did the lifting of the sanctions pave the way for now Sudan to be removed from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism?
The two issues are not linked, but I cannot say that they are being linked. As you know, that both are separate. But they both of them, they show the relations and ties between the two countries. Because politics is not away from the economic sanctions, nor from being on the list of countries supporting terrorism. But as you know, two on different pathways, because lifting Sudan from the list of countries supporting terrorism entails an engagement, and a direct engagement by the Congress, and maybe the Senate as well, apart from the decision is supposed to start from His Excellency the President. And this is why we agreed from the beginning, from June 2016, that we go state by state, and now stage one is over, and we continue in the same positive spirit in stage two, which is supposed to lead us to normalization of relations between the two.
Professor Ibrahim Gandour, Sudan's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Victims of former Gambian president Yahya Jammeh and some international activists have launched a campaign to bring Jammeh to justice. Sini Marana reports from Banjul.
As they convey for yet another meeting, local victims and activists from different civil society and advocacy groups, including US-based Human Rights Watch, are joining forces to ensure Mr. Jammeh faces justice. The victim stories of forced disappearance, torture, and kidnapping are incredibly heart-wracking. The gathering was a follow-up to previous meeting conveyed to organize and prepare processes towards eventual prosecution.
We, his family, have been going through immeasurable pain for the past 4.5 years. And today I stand here because, and let me say this very loud and clear, we want answers and we want justice.
A vast number of human rights groups are strongly backing the resolution, which demand include a strong call to the government of Equatorial Guinea to extradite the former Gambian leader.
We are committed to attain our ultimate goal, which is to ensure that Yahya Jammeh, as well as those who bear the greatest responsibility in the crimes of his government, are brought to trial with all due process guaranteed.
Who has been the full breadth of Jammeh brutality, having experienced a near-death circumstance, Imam Babali's story re-enacts the vicious circle of state sanction oppression that he said was the norm under Jammeh government.
There's no type of torture that I haven't encountered.
Former political prisoner Dr. Amadou Skatou Jannah clearly understands this systematic process of illegal detention, torture, extrajudicial killing that shadowed Jammeh's 22-year rule. When he finally moved to take action, a simple imprint of democratic expressions on T-shirt would fetch him a death penalty.
Rainy season, getting wet at Bamba Dinka, even had athlete's foot. And all they did was to give me a sugar to say, you know, that cures it. And the type of ordeal I went through, if we start discussing that here, you'll be here all day, but I've written a book on it.
They call him Dictator Hunter, the prosecutor of many former tyrants. Reid Broody believes if victim stories are allowed to flourish, Jammeh prosecution will soon and swiftly expedite it.
Yeah, I worked for 18 years with the victims of Hissin Habre. People thought that that was never going to happen. What we showed in that case was that if you put the stories of the victims in the center, if you talk about what happened to them and their struggle, that you can create the political conditions, as in the Habre case, even in Africa, to bring a former African president to court.
Jammeh fled the Gambia in January 2017 for exile in Equatorial Guinea after losing presidential election to current President Adama Barrow. Reporting for VOA News in Banjul, I am Sini M. Kim Marek.
The Inspector General of Police of Liberia says the police will not allow demonstrations by people who might be dissatisfied with the results of the 2017 elections. Gregory Coleman says while every Liberian has the constitutional right of protest, anyone not satisfied with the election results should seek redress through the courts. In another development, Inspector General Coleman said he was never asked by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to support either Senator George Weah or Vice President Joseph Boakai in the runoff election scheduled for November 7th this year.
Absolutely not. I've gotten no such request from no one whosoever.
So where do you think the story is coming from?
Well, I do not know from which perspective it's been written, but I know I was asked the same question by the journalist from Front Page whether I had been requested to resign, and I told them no. As far as I'm concerned, I enjoy the full confidence of the president. She has guided this process quite well. She has remained exceptionally professional, have never asked me one day to step out of the confines of the law. So I don't know where that story is coming from, but the Alberta National Police remains 100% neutral in the process, facilitating a level playing field for all. We are not partisans. We are a state asset that has to be made available to the people at this point in time for election security and even beyond that.
Again, I haven't clearly looked at the story itself. Did the story say that you should support, say, the ruling party or which party?
Well, I haven't seen the story myself, but I know I was asked by journalists from Front Page whether I had been asked to support any party, and I told them no. And then they went on to ask if you were. I told them, well, if I was, I would gladly resign before I was to even do that. And I reminded them of the same level of professionalism and confidence that I've enjoyed from my excellency.
This does not mean that the police are not going to vote. Are you going to vote?
We all are going to vote. The one thing we ask our officers to do is to vote their conscience when they get in there, but nobody is instructed to vote any party line.
So, Mr. Inspector General, how prepared are the police? As you know, the runoff is coming November 7th. How do you think the police did in protecting the ballot or the voters in the first round? And how prepared are you for the second round?
By virtue of the preservation of our peace and no violence on our streets, we can tell you that the police performed excellently well in the first round. And in our quest to continue to advance accountability, yesterday we began action after action review, looking at how we did it, what happened, how we did it, and also to prepare ourselves to do it better in the second round. And let me use this medium as well to thank the Liberian people for the manner in which they conducted themselves during the first round of elections. And I am very, very hopeful that conduct will even be better during these times. I would like to say that all candidates that believe the system to have their register to even come to vote to contest the seat. So if you believe in the system partially to come in and register, you should believe in the system to be able to seek redress through the rule of law, even if you are dissatisfied. If there's any dissatisfaction, we're advising people to respect the rights of others through the rule of law, go to the courts and seek a redress. Absolutely no form of demonstration will be tolerated in the Monrovia because it's for the greater good of the safety of the masses.
Gregory Coleman is the Inspector General of the Liberia National Police. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A bakery in a low-income area of Johannesburg slashed prices of its popular bread with unexpected results. What started as a way to help feed the community became a recipe for success, as the bakery has a lot more business than ever. Viewer Arash Arabasadi reports.
This South African bakery has a good problem. Its bread baking business is on the rise.
It's every day rough day, I'll put it that way, because of the pressure keeps going up.
Nicholas Rafilo owns the Barotho Bakery in a low-income area of Johannesburg. He invested about $2,000 to open the shop, and since cutting his prices in half to about 44 cents per loaf, his shop's output has gone from 40 loaves a day to 600 in just 1 year.
The bread is nice. It makes good kotas, and people love them. The price is right, it's very good, and we can actually afford it.
With business booming, Rafilo employs a staff of four working to keep up with a demand so high some customers come from out of town.
It's helpful because it's cheap and fresh. That's why I come from far to buy them.
Rafilo launched the Barotho Bakery at a time when other bakers hiked their prices to keep pace with inflation. He saw an opportunity to cut prices but still sell quality bread.
So the bread is very nice. It's very smooth. It's so smooth and small, and it's smooth and it's soft. It's right for eating for breakfast.
But the demand for his bread is high and ever increasing.
So we are working as a team whereby we understand where we want to go with our business. Though it's not easy, we put it that way, it takes a personal sacrifices and compromises to win this situation.
Rufilo is now looking to open a second shop, hoping to meet the growing hunger for his bread. Arash Arvasati, VOA News.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the CAF Champions League as Egyptian giants Al Ahly and Morocco's Wydad Casablanca set up an all North African final in the elite continental club competition this past weekend. Al Ahly were in spectacular form, scoring 6 goals as they crushed Tunisian side Etoile du Sahel 6-2 in the second leg of their CAF Champions League semi-finals at the Burj Al Arab Stadium on Sunday night. On Saturday, Wydad Casablanca defeated USM Alger 3-1 to book their spot in the final. In the CAF Confederations Cup, holders TP Mazembe booked their place after playing out a barren draw against FUS Rabat to reach their successive final via a 1-0 aggregate score thanks to a Ben Malango's 14th-minute winner in the first leg 3 weeks ago in Lubumbashi. The DR Congo Giants remain on course to win back-to-back titles in the second-tier continental club competition, a record only achieved by Tunisia's CS Sfaxien in 2007 and 2008. TP Mazembe will meet South Africa's SuperSport United, who advanced into the final of the 2017 CAF Confederations Cup following a 4-2 aggregate win over Club Africain in Raids on Sunday. We're still with football news, and Egypt's Football Association announced on Sunday that its locally based football team will not participate in the upcoming African Nations Championship CHAN 2018 due to their busy domestic league schedule. Thawat Swildman, executive manager of the EFA, told reporters that their participation in the CHAN tournament will require a domestic league break, and the Football Federation can't afford that. And now to the FIFA Under-17 World Cup currently taking place in India. Mali will meet Spain in the semi-finals after beating their West African rivals Ghana 2-1. The defeat of Ghana Black Starlets was the third in 6 months in the hands of the Malians after they had pipped the Starlets to win the 2017 Under-17 AFCON in Gabon and followed it up with a 2-1 win in a friendly in the United Arab Emirates. Ghana Black Starlets coach Samuel Pakwesi Fabian blamed his team's loss on poor officiating.
Everything went right. You scored a perfect goal. It was disallowed. We don't understand it. I mean, the officiating has been very, very, very bad. That's what I have to say.
In athletics news, Kenya's Jocelyn Jepkosgei kept her stellar 2017 momentum alive at the Valencia Trinidad Alfonso Half Marathon, taking 1 second off her own world record to create a new world record as she won the IWAF Gold Label Road Race in 1 hour 4 minutes 51 seconds on Sunday. Fancy Chimutai and Lucy Chiriot joined Jepkosgei on the podium to get a clean sweep of medals for Kenya. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, October 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a productive week.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.